Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has experienced teams who can craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex. Real wealth requires real solutions. Connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com.
The latest episode of the Next 5 podcast is all about health prevention and vaccines. I speak to Kate Hashey at GSK.
For every dollar invested in improving health, there's an economic return of $2 to $4.
Murray Aitken at IQVIA Institute for Human Data Science.
The benefits of adult vaccination are compelling.
And David Sinclair at the International Longevity Centre.
Preventable conditions amongst those aged 50 to 64 in the UK cost $27 billion a year.
Listen to the full episode of the Next 5 wherever you get your podcasts.
The FT.
Beer, burritos and baristas. You can back all sorts of up-and-coming businesses via the mini bonds market, but is this form of investing too spicy for your average investor? Plus, we analysed the fast-growing pensions drawdown market, which has taken off following April's pensions freedoms, and a trip to the hairdressers inspires me to ask, is there any such thing as a defensive share? Welcome to the FT Money Show, the FT's most popular weekly podcast. I'm Claire Barrett, and I'll be giving you all the week's money news in downloadable form with the help of my FT colleagues Judith Evans, Joe Cumbo, and our special studio guest, adventurous investor David Stevenson, the FT Money columnist. Mini bonds have exploded onto the retail investment scene in recent years, with a rising number of businesses, be they burrito makers to beer brewers, tapping the market for cash. Scottish brewer BrewDog launched a £6 million mini bond just last week. But what should investors make of this? I'm joined in the FT studio by David Stevenson, our adventurous investor, and also by Judith Evans, FT Money reporter, who's written extensively about mini bonds in the past. David and Judith, thanks for joining us today. Firstly, explain to us, what is a mini bond and what are the two things you say in your column investors should consider before buying one?
Bonds are very straightforward IOUs, and then you have retail bonds, which most people sort of understand. They're traded in the stock market. They're usually transferable. You can invest in them. You can trade in them.
Big companies use them.
Yeah, absolutely. And smaller companies use them as well, the retail bond market. And charities use them. That's one of the most interesting bits of the market. Mini bonds, by default, tend to be non-transferable. So effectively what that means is that when you buy it, you have to hold it through to maturity. So there's no secondary market. You can't ring a stockbroker up and go, hi, I'd like to sell my retail
bond. You can't
bond.
Get out of it.
No, you can't get out of it. You have to hold it through to maturity. And I suppose the other big risk as well is that a lot of retail bonds, for instance, are quite often secured. And they're usually fairly senior, not always. And what we mean by that is both security, they've got an asset back against them. So a classic example is there was a charity bond done by on the retail stock market, which is a local charity near to me, and it was secured on the local properties, actually, in their case, assisted care properties. And it was relatively senior, which meant that there wasn't a lot of debt above it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. The problem with a lot of mini bonds is they're quite often not senior. Okay, so there's stuff sitting above them. And they're quite often unsecured, so you don't have any assets that you secure them on. That's not always the case, but that usually is the case. So they are subordinated, they are a higher risk, and I suppose that the core of it as well is that they're non-transferable. That's the thing that gets me, because at the end of the day, if you don't like a bond on a stock market, you can just sell it, and you can just crystallise the loss and you can get out. So the things you have to watch out for, there are specific risks in mini bonds as well. One of the two big specific risks, I suppose, I'd be looking at is, one, will you get your money back? Because if they're
that's the obvious one.
Yeah, because if they're non-transferable, you have to wait around to maturity. That's a big, big factor, that is. That's an important question in the mini bond market, because as you quite rightly said in the introduction, they tend to be backing earlier stage businesses. You know, you're backing much, much younger companies than the bigger companies on the
it's
retail bond market.
It's almost venture capitalism for investors.
Yeah, well, it's almost venture capitalism, but without venture capital returns, isn't it, really?
Well, this is the second thing that you said.
Yes, because then the second, so will you get your money back? Are you being adequately rewarded for the risk? Now, what is the risk here? There is the risk of not being paid back, but there are other risks as well. What happens if interest rates go up? There's what happens if there are systematic risks in the business? There's a duration risk. So a bond that I'm sure we're going to talk a bit about, to the BrewDog bond, is a four-year mini bond. Yeah. Now, 4 years is a long time in a business. Okay. So do I think, for instance, that it will go bust next year, this year? No, I don't think it will. I think it's adequately funded in equity.
Well, certainly their beer is very nice.
Yeah, it's a fantastic. It's a great brand. 4 years is a long time for a business, particularly where, I keep going back to, it's non-transferable. So you have to be sure that you're that duration of 4 years, you're happy with the interest rate risk and the default risk. And I suppose my question is, are you being adequately rewarded? And I've looked at two bonds in the piece. One is from an outfit called Walker, who do short-term funding, and they did it on a thing called UK Bonds Network. And another one from BrewDog, who do fantastic beers. And that's been put on the CrowdCube network. And I think the chances of default on either are very low. Not impossible, but very low. But do I think you're being adequately rewarded for the risk that you're taking in terms of the maturity, the length of time? I think of the BrewDog one, probably not.
So with the interest rates, this is obviously what's attracting investors. They're really tempting,
yeah.
You know, sometimes as high as 10% on mini bonds. But it can't be a coincidence that so many raises have been from consumer brands, not just BrewDog, but there's also been Chilango, which is a burrito, Mexican burrito restaurant. And there's also chains of coffee, Taylor River Cottage. They're all brands that we know and love as consumers. And it's then a small leap in the mind to think, oh, should I invest in something that I like eating or drinking?
Yeah, so I suppose the cynical observer in me would say, well, that is the point, isn't it? Because they're after the retail market, and it's much easier to sell to the retail market, because I know that if I went to a big corporate investor, an institutional investor, and I offered to, you know, borrow money for 4 years, they would say, in the case of BrewDog, 6.5, absolutely not at all. You know, there's quite a lot of risk, and we want to charge more. And in reality, it's been told to me by quite a few people that the retail market is sometimes a bit more of a pushover, in a sense that actually institutional investors would absolutely not put up with some of the terms that are being out there. And in fact, that's why they quite often use brands. But it's also important to say that some of those brands that we mentioned, they're perfectly good businesses, and some of the bonds are actually not bad. That's the point about bonds. You have to look at every single bond. You have to look at the T&Cs. You have to look at what the terms and conditions are. You have to understand the brand, and you have to do the same level of due diligence, as, in my opinion, as you would buy in the shares.
Well, that's very good advice. Judith, to bring you into this discussion, you wrote in FT Money not so long ago that mini bonds as a form of investment are on the rise. But do you think that investors are aware of the risks attached?
I think in many cases they're not, because as you mentioned, David, these companies are going directly to the retail consumer, to the person in the street who isn't necessarily going to know the background to these. I spoke to several investors in secured energy bonds, which was a mini bond that actually collapsed. The money mysteriously ended up in an Australian company that subsequently went bust. And they were definitely not aware of the risks when they invested. They were attracted in by the headline interest rate. They didn't realise that this was unregulated, that it was in effect unsecured, that there was very little information available about the company behind it. And some of them indeed were in professions such as care worker, where there's no reason for you to really have that financial expertise. So that was something that I found very worrying.
Well, certainly it's of interest to our readers why this area of the market isn't regulated, if, as we've seen, it's so often aimed at consumers and advertised openly, for example, in tube stations.
Well, that's a good point. I think one reason for this is that the government is keen to encourage investment in small businesses, and they're also keen to encourage alternative finance, both of which can be great things. But the Financial Conduct Authority, that's the city regulator, has repeatedly reviewed the way that it's covering the sector, and it is going to do so again. And they've told me that that will include mini bonds. So I wonder if they might at some point be prompted to reconsider and perhaps introduce some regulation for this sector.
Well, thanks very much, Judith. Still to come on the show, FT Money has analysed data from all of the major UK pension providers to ascertain how drawdown has been revolutionised following April's pensions freedoms. But before that, my Serious Money column in FT Money this weekend has been inspired by a trip to the hairdressers. A school careers advisor once told me that hairdressing was a recession-proof business, as people will always need to get their hair cut. Thankfully, I ignored her career advice and became a journalist instead, but a trip to my own crimper this week revealed this maxim is hardly true. She's just sold the lease on her salon to a men's barber's, and he can afford the higher rent as, unlike her, he can sustain a higher volume business, with men coming back for a repeat trim every 2 weeks, taking less time to cut their hair and require comparatively little capital outlay in terms of dyes and products. So seeing how a supposedly defensive business can get the chop got me thinking about defensive shares in general and how resilient their business models truly are. Still with us is David Stevenson. Now, David, your fans know you as the adventurous investor, but actually you've invested in various defensive funds over the years as well. Now, what would you characterise as a classic defensive share, and how has that definition perhaps changed over the years?
Well, I think investing is prey to the same kind of fad for kind of labels as every other form of life. And so you hear the word defensive, it means stocks like utilities, stocks like probably tobacco companies, probably sit in that category. And they're defensive because they tend to move up and down by less than the market. They tend to have a kind of dividend backing, not always, but usually.
So some income stream.
The problem with it is that it's become slightly overused because sometimes it veers into quality. Quality stocks, Diageo, classic example, the enormous consumer brands company. Unilever is probably another example. They're quality stocks. What that means is that they have defensive-like qualities, but also they quite often have a very strong balance sheet. They have a big moat of competitive advantage, you know, and it's very difficult. Warren Buffett loves buying quality stocks. Now, quality stocks are not the same as defensive stocks, and that's an important distinction. And a lot of institutions love quality stocks, so Diageo and Unilever shares are very highly overvalued.
They certainly are.
Whereas actually most utility companies are quite lowly valued, very high dividend yield, and they're usually not valued much above book value. So if we accept that term, that labelling that's going on, it is interesting that people do like both sets of stocks, but for slightly different reasons. Most wealth managers, for instance, love quality stocks, full of their portfolios. A lot of income-orientated portfolio managers love utility stocks because it gives them a steady income. But the reality is both of them have done fairly well in the recent spike in volatility, or as less worse than the wider market, I should say.
But when it comes to business models within the sector, like take an area like the supermarkets. Now, at one point, they would have been considered a defensive stock, certainly when the financial crisis first bit. Yeah. People thought, well, we'll still have to go to Tesco's or Sainsbury's to buy all of our shopping. And they were considered to be quite resilient areas. But then, obviously, we know what's happened
since
then. Since
friendly
then.
Germans.
I know, the German invasion of Aldi and Lidl, but also the wider consumer trend away from shopping in giant hypermarkets to doing a local top-up shop in smaller stores weekly, which has really hammered the outlay that they've had to spend on these big stores. So, I mean, that's how the supermarket sector has been disrupted. But are there any other examples that you can think of in the defensive realm?
Well, actually, you know, there's been worries even about tobacco, actually. So the tobacco companies' results have held up remarkably well. But it's never quite gone away that people are worried that with the increasing, you know, regulation they're subject to, the advertising bans, and increasingly they're under-targeted in their third world markets. You're beginning to see more and more kind of cynics and sceptics break cover and say, actually, you know, even the boring old tobacco companies could be under attack. We haven't quite seen that in evidential terms yet. They've held up fairly well, possibly a measure of the degree to which their clients are addicted. Utility stocks have fallen out of favour a lot in America, and that's again from a structural change that you've sort of implied here with supermarkets. And the structural change there is that the regulators have turned around and said, well, we actually want you to have a lower return on capital. And they've said, well, actually, you've been ripping customers off. Yeah. And we'd rather you actually get smaller profits. And arguably, you could have seen that if Labour had come into power with under Ed Miliband's arguments about freezing the price. That would have been a direct impact on a lot of defensive-orientated stocks like SSE, Scottish Southern Energy, which I happen to own. You know, I can't say most SSE shareholders were probably not particularly enthused by the prospect of having their energy prices freeze because they wouldn't make profit. Now, that didn't happen. But actually, it has been happening anyway, though, that the utility model has been changing. And there is a lot of pressure on them now across the board from the regulators to lower their kind of return on equity. And that has... We see the most direct effect of that, actually, not in the UK, but in America, where individual individual states, regulators have got really tough on utilities. And utility stocks in America are very popular with ordinary investors. They love it. They're defensive. They're income orientated. But the regulators got tough in some states and said, no, actually, you're going to charge a hell of a lot less in proportional terms. And a lot of utility stocks have never really had a bounce back in the last 3 or 4 years in America. And they've been serial underperformers in a really quite major way. Even Warren Buffett, he's been buying utility stocks because he thinks there's good value in them. And again, we go back to that issue about labels. When does a defensive become good value? So do you know what I mean? So when all these companies slip around between these various categories, quality, defensive, value. And Tesco's is another classic example. I know a couple of very good value investors who would never have touched Tesco's a few years ago because they thought it was richly priced and expensive. Now they're all buying
Tesco. The yellow sticker has been applied.
Yes, exactly. And I suppose the other issue we've also got to disentangle from the defensive debate is the UK debate, the UK-focused debate.
So that's a good point.
So what we're talking really about here is that some defensive companies have done a lot better in the last few months. So here's a classic example. I look at a lot of index stats, and there's a bunch of guys over at Société Générale who look at all the indices, and they look at all the different indices. And if you look at something like the FTSE 100 or the MSCI World, big benchmark indices, there are usually different versions of these indices. And they're all sorts of things, high growth, small cap, all that kind of stuff. But one of them's out there is a thing called minimum or low volatility. It's a complicated term. All it means is they don't bounce around very much. Mm. And they are, by and large, defensive stocks. And to use one frame of reference, at one point, the MSCI World or the FTSE 100 was down 9% over a month. The average low vol version of that was down 2%. But interestingly, UK small caps are down 2% as well. Now, that's surely not right because small caps, they're much riskier, you know, they're much scarier. But the reality of it is what we've seen in the last month is a flight from anything to do with China, emerging markets or international trade. But if you're UK focused, like a lot of small caps are, and quite a lot of defensive stocks are UK focused, they've actually done better than the market because the UK economy is clearly holding up. So look, China may be falling over and exporters to China will have a hard time. But actually, UK focused stocks are actually not doing too badly because actually the UK economy is okay.
Well, you could say they're doubly well insulated.
Dum-bum.
Well, thanks very much. That Pleasure. Was David Stevenson, the FT's adventurous investor, and you can read David's column in this week's edition of FT Money. Before our final item, a reminder that you can read this week's FT Money as part of the Weekend FT, widely available on both Saturday and Sunday, or read us online, ft.com/money, and follow us on Twitter, @FTMoney. As we approach the 6-month anniversary of pension freedoms, the popularity of drawdown investments has unsurprisingly grown. FT Money pensions correspondent Joe Cumbo has been crunching data from all of the major pension providers to see how the landscape has changed since April. This is particularly pertinent following stock market volatility in China, which subsequently spread around the world, as drawdown is obviously a riskier route for pension savers than the certainty that an annuity would have provided. Now, Joe's findings, which will be published in FT Money in full this weekend, show that though drawdown products were designed for more sophisticated investors with substantial savings, they are now entering the mainstream, albeit with some problems attached. So, Joe, what are the main trends and concerns that you found out about in your research?
I started looking into this market because, as you highlighted, drawdown was a product up until about 18 months ago, which was a niche product, and it was really something that you got into if you were wealthy, if you had about £200,000, good enough asset base to withstand any stock market
any
swings
and
gyrations,
yeah.
And you could sleep through it basically, not panic if things were moving in the market. Freedoms have transformed what drawdown is completely. Now, people don't have to buy an annuity. There's a bigger attraction. Drawdown has reinvented itself as a mass market product. In 2013, before the freedoms were announced, only 20,000 drawdown policies were sold, but that has more than doubled in 2014 as people move into drawdown, and they're moving in because providers are reducing the minimum fund sizes to allow them in. So it's moving into the mass market now.
So 200,000 you may have needed beforehand.
Yes.
But what's the kind of minimum pot size now?
Out of the dozen or so providers who responded to the survey, I asked them to tell me a few things about their clients, what the changes they'd made in response to the free. The majority of them had lowered their minimum fund sizes to £30,000, which is about to capture the average pension pot, really. And in many cases, that had dropped to £10,000, so much lower, and some firms had even scrapped minimum fund requirements for existing customers.
So a lot of the people coming in who've really bumped up the numbers of drawdown yes. Products being sold are going to be smaller investors.
They're going to be people who probably don't have investment experience. And let's not forget that for most people, they would have built up their retirement pots in the workplace in default funds and they wouldn't be engaged. They're not investment managers. They won't have investment experience. But the market is now moving. Drawdown is moving into the space to capture interest in people who aren't necessarily having investment experience but interested in moving into drawdown.
So what are the risks for these smaller investors? Aside from maybe being unnerved by the gyrating markets, as you've said, they also might not be very savvy about spotting what's a high fee and what isn't.
Well, my survey has a snapshot of how the market has moved, and it's moving really fast from the old world of being targeting these wealthier investors who might have advisors to the mass market. And what I've found is that the old charging structures, which suit and more suited to wealthy investors, are still in place, and that investors with smaller funds are really at risk if they get, if they stumble into a scheme or a drawdown product with these structures, which are more suited to higher funds, so they'll get penalised. For example, what I found was that the charging structures for many providers will give discounts to bigger funds so that the market isn't really geared up for smaller funds.
The fees will kind of decrease on a sliding scale,
yes,
the more money you have.
Yes, that's right. So the market is still geared up for bigger funds, so smaller funds are subsidising, in effect, the bigger funds. And also, the charging structures are typically, you'll see in AMC, which is the headline rate, and beyond that, there will be a raft of charges, including transfer in fees, admin fees, setup charges, all that. And if they're flat fees, those kind of charges can disproportionately hurt a smaller fund than a bigger fund,
yeah,
which can absorb
a bigger ratio. Yeah.
So
you've got saved up.
Some providers have changed their models to more percentage based fees that are all in. So a total cost charge, for example, Standard Life has done that. They've said very clearly, we want to be mass market. This is going to be sensitive to pot size, etc. But many other providers in the survey are still operating these charging structures, which are suited to bigger funds, and that's fine. Because perhaps we do need choice in this market. But what I've uncovered after going through the process of trying to gather this information...
Well, yeah, and you're an expert.
It's completely complex to get all this information, and so nigh impossible to compare product propositions because they're all different. They use different terms. So, I mean, from anyone starting out from scratch, trying to compare what might be good, it's very difficult. But it shouldn't just be about cost, Claire, because as the market has... gyrations have shown us recently that if you're getting into the stock market, you can get your fingers burnt really quickly. And if you're an investor who isn't sure, doesn't have much experience, you don't know about your capacity for loss or what your objectives are, you could get burnt. And let's not forget, if it's your retirement fund and you're not putting any more money in it as you go on, your capacity for loss is going to be much smaller than had you done this when you were in your 30s and still in a job.
Well, lots to think about there and some very interesting research for us to pore over in FT Weekend. Thanks very much, Jo Cumbo, the FT's pensions correspondent. We'd love to know what you think about pensions drawdown, the death of defensives, or about money matters more generally. You can get in touch with us via email. Our address is money@ft.com, or you can tweet us at FTMoney. And you can leave comments at the foot of individual articles on our website at ft.com/money. There's just time to tell you what else is in this weekend's edition. We reveal the taxpayers who are a thorn in the side of HMRC, and we probe the city regulator's softening attitude to equity release products. Plus, we've share tips from our sister publication, The Investor's Chronicle, and the latest director's deals. The Money Show will be back next week, but for now, it's goodbye from me, David, Judith and Joe.
For more downloads, go to ft.com/podcasts.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Coriant.
Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has experienced teams who can craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex. Real wealth requires real solutions. Connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com.
The latest episode of the Next 5 podcast is out now, and it's all about AI and creativity. I speak to Doug Eck, Senior Research Director at Google DeepMind.
Creativity is part and parcel of humanity.
YouTube creator Danny Vidari.
AI can give us humans new ideas.
And Neil Maiden, Professor of Digital Creativity at City University London.
AI creates a lot of opportunities. I think it's a great leveler.
Listen to the full episode of The Next 5 wherever you get your podcasts. Enjoy.